KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
The American people don't expect government to solve every problem. They don't expect those of us in this chamber to agree on every issue. But they do expect us to put the nation's interests before party.
I don't like the sequester. I think it's taking a meat axe to our government, a meat axe to many programs, and it will weaken our national defense.
We need to change the way we pay for higher education. Now, I believe in federal financial aid. I couldn't have gone to college without it. But it's not just about spending more money. It's also about strengthening and modernizing them.
That's Senator Marco Rubio in the president's in the response from the Republicans to the president's State of the Union message. You're listening to Weekday. I'm Steve Scherer. We thought we'd get some responses as well. You also heard John Boehner talking about the sequester and the president taking a look at what's happening in the economy as well. Adam Smith is a representative from the 9th District, joins us to give us his thoughts. Representative Smith, thank you very much.
Count me on. I appreciate the chance.
We reached out to many of your Republican colleagues. We didn't get a response, the same response from them. We hope someday to get some of your Republican colleagues on our air. But so far
you guys are very, very even-handed and good interview. So I will pass along a positive word. I mean, I go on Fox.
Yeah, there you go. We try. Here's what Kathy McMorris Rogers said. She said, "I was disappointed that he didn't bring us together more. Find that common ground, provide that leadership that the country needs if we're going to get the economy growing and the people back to work. Extremely disappointed that I didn't recognize the impact of the debt and the record debt and deficits and the impact that's having on our economy." I think she was referring to the fact that one thing the president talked about was they were going to get that deficit under control, stabilize the debt, he said.
Right.
But he didn't talk as much about reducing the debt or balancing the federal budget. What do you think?
Well, he did talk about reducing the debt. I mean, that's the purpose of stabilizing. You know, like, this is a policy difference. Republicans advocate a balanced budget, like right now. I and the president and many others think that level, that approach to the fiscal policy would be devastating to our economy, that the size of our deficit right now, the programs and the tax code that are in place and the fragile nature of our economy means that if we were to balance the budget that quickly, the cuts and or tax increases that you would have to implement would push us into a deep and lasting recession. So what we need to do is get the deficit under control. Now, I disagree with the people on the other end of the spectrum, and I've heard them as well, that say, oh, the debt and the deficit aren't a problem. It's job growth. Ignore the debt and the deficit. I don't agree with that, but over the course of 10 years, getting the deficit under control, keeping it, getting it back down to around 50% of GDP, for instance, that's manageable, and it also would begin to give some confidence to investors and to the public that the federal government is going to be able to get its fiscal house in order and have some consistency. So it's the balance of that. And yes, I think there are some Republicans who think, nope, balance it right now. I think that's wrong. I think the president does too, and that's the source of that disagreement.
You know, NPR did an analysis. One thing they talked about was that he didn't take Medicare and Social Security into more solvency with these proposals. Did you hear or do you know of proposals that the president is offering that you think does do that?
I mean, look, the thing about the State of the Union speech, the Republican response and comments like the one that you got from Representative McMorris Rogers is they're all very vague. They have sort of a general notion that we want to move in a positive direction on all manner of different things without really sort of getting down into the nitty-gritty. And I think it's a reasonable criticism that the president didn't say, all right, here's what I'm going to do on mandatory spending. Here's how I'm going to get it under control, and talk more in general terms about how we do that. And look, this is a huge problem in our public policy debate writ large on taxes, on mandatory programs. We talk about how we want to do tax reform. We talk about how we want to do entitlement reform. And so the image that people are able to conjure up in their mind, on taxes, it's that, we're going to magically redo the tax code so that, nobody pays more, but we wind up with more money. We're going to magically restructure mandatory programs so that they're stronger and better and we can afford them, but nobody's going to, have to suffer any cut. And personally, I've always been more, you know, blunt, direct, and honest about the choices we face. And I think we would benefit from saying, well, we've got to raise taxes. Somebody's got to pay more if we're going to get the deficit under control. And on mandatory spending programs, we have to find a way to spend less. Yes, there are more efficient ways to do that than others, but, you know, conjuring up in people's minds the notion that somehow we can do those two things without raising taxes on anyone or cutting any mandatory programs, I don't think that's helpful long-term, and maybe helpful short-term in terms of polling data, but it's not helpful in terms of getting to solutions, and I think both parties need to do a better job of being honest about those things.
You know, in terms of being honest, is there ever going to be a point where, acknowledging that we are transferring wealth from young people to older people at a pretty rapid rate right now,
absolutely,
are we going to ask those people who are currently getting and have their, you know, with wealth, getting their Social Security or their Medicare, are we going to ask them to pay a little more?
Yeah, I don't know. I'll be honest with you. I think we should. Now, you know, I'll say, as I said in the outset, I don't support balancing the budget, you know, this year or next year or even any time in the near future because of the size of the impact that that would have and where we're at in the economy. I support getting under control. I'm also, you know, unabashedly in favor of raising taxes. You know, we've cut taxes for the last 15 years. I think it's somewhere in the neighborhood of $7 trillion in tax cuts that have been put in place over the last 10 years. You know, we've seen the impact of that. We've also increased spending. I think, you know, we just had a big hearing on sequestration in the Armed Services Committee. I think certainly we're going to have to spend less on defense than current law contemplates. But mandatory programs are 58% of the budget, and you just don't get there towards dealing with a $1 trillion deficit if you don't make some adjustments in those mandatory programs that reduces what you spend on them. So, yes, I think we're going to have to look at that. You know, the president floated the idea of the chain CPI. That is one specific idea that he threw out there. Chain CPI would basically both raise taxes and reduce the amount of money that we're paying out in mandatory programs. I think those ideas have to be seriously considered. We just can't keep hanging back and saying, well, we have to do something, just not that. We have to get more specific. And I don't think last night's, you know, back and forth between the Democrats and the Republicans really helped at all in getting to that greater specificity.
Adam Smith is a representative in Congress from the 9th Congressional District in Washington State. You mentioned the sequester. Let me ask you a couple questions about that. And a favor, if you would, what is, define sequester for us?
It's funny. When I type the word sequestration on my BlackBerry, it shows up as not being a word. But I guess it is a word. All it means, basically, is you automatically cut spending in certain programs. Sequester means we're holding back the money. You know, so if, you know, Congress didn't meet certain requirements from the Budget Control Act, automatically money is held back. Now, almost all of that money is held back from discretionary spending programs. This is opposite of the mandatory programs I was talking about earlier. It's about 38% of the budget. And by the way, the difference there is interest on the debt, which I guess technically is a mandatory program as well, because we do have to pay it. But in the discretionary portion of the budget, it's defense, transportation, education, infrastructure, wide variety of different programs. And what sequestration said is, if you don't get a deficit reduction plan, we're going to automatically cut those discretionary programs. There's also a little bit of mandatory automatic cuts in there as well, but mostly discretionary budget. So, you know, that's what it is. It's an automatic blind across the board cut that really isn't at all strategic in its thinking.
People are taking some odds that maybe the sequestration is going to happen. If it does happen, what impact does it have on Joint Base Lewis-McChord, on Bangor, on defense spending in our state?
Pretty profound. And a lot of people will lose their jobs. There will be less money spent. I think the biggest impact aside from that on the defense is their ability to train and make sure that the troops are ready if they're called to fulfill the missions that we're asking them to fulfill. Because that's the quickest, easiest way to save money. I mean, we've got sunk costs on big programs and a lot of other things, but you can always, you know, fire less shots at the rifle range. You can fly less hours in the plane. You can do less training in the ships, and that saves money. But that reduces the readiness of our forces. And what readiness means is, all right, we're telling you, here's the mission. We're training you for it, and if it happens, you go. Now, if it happens, they're not going to be trained and ready. And this has happened throughout our history. At the start of the Korean War, at the start of World War II, you know, we had forces that were, you know, beaten badly and lives were lost, at least in part, because they were not ready. They were not trained for the mission that they were then asked to do. But this also goes beyond defense. I mean, every government agency out there is going to be laying people off and reducing the number of services that are available to the public. It's going to have a very real impact.
The alarms are raised over defense by a lot of critics. People say that because of the meat cleaver approach, Defense Department budget managers can't pick and choose what they are going to do. Couldn't they in some way figure out ways to shift money so that training occurs but lawns are mowed less?
Yeah. No, actually. First of all, they're very limited in terms of how they can move the money. It's the law, and it says every program's got to be cut by the same amount. So their ability to move it around is going to be difficult. Second of all, they could stop mowing all the lawns all across the military, and they wouldn't even begin to get the money that's necessary to help them. So this is not a matter of, oh, gosh, if they just cut the waste or if they just cut that. I mean, they've been doing that for 2 years as they've dealt with, you know, continual reductions in the budget, inability of Congress to pass appropriations bills so that they've had to live with a continuing resolution that doesn't enable them the type of flexibility they need. So, no, we are definitely down to the bone here. And, again, I'll emphasize not just in defense, but in a ton of other programs. And the one final thing I'll say is, you know, we could change the mission of the Department of Defense. We could say, you know, we're not going to need to be ready to go fight North Korea if they invade South Korea. We're not going to be ready to stop Iran if they want to, you know, mine the Strait of Hormuz. You know, there's a whole series of things that we are currently preparing to do that we could say, nope, we're just not going to do that. I mean, we could change that overall strategy and then build our defense force to that, but that would have consequences.
By the way, in terms of Washington State, do you have numbers about how many people might lose their jobs if sequestration goes through?
I don't. We obviously have a very strong defense presence. So it will impact us and has already impacted us as they've been getting ready for it and also dealing with the lack of an appropriations bill for the last 2 years. So as an impact, I don't have the numbers. I'm sorry.
All right. Fair enough. Adam Smith is our guest. All right. One thing the president and the administration addressed, and they've been criticized over the authority to order drone strikes on American citizens abroad. You talked about this before. Here's what President Obama said last night when he made a call for greater transparency.
And I recognize that in our democracy, no one should just take my word for it that we're doing things the right way. So in the months ahead, I will continue to engage Congress to ensure not only that our targeting, detention, and prosecution of terrorists remains consistent with our laws and system of checks and balances, but that our efforts are even more transparent to the American people and to the world.
You know, there's the president. He just got a smattering of applause on that line, Adam Smith. And I was wondering, are you satisfied with the checks and balance on the president's authority here?
I think we need to do better, and I would agree with what the president said. We need to move forward on this. You know, I think it's very difficult, though, and I think people, you know, the drone aspect of it has sort of, you know, been the main focus and has really missed the larger debate of the fact that we're fighting this fundamentally different kind of war. And we're not just using these drones to contain some minor problem. We're using these drones as part of the war with Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda declared war on us in 1996, and they've carried out that war in a variety of different ways. And, you know, we're punching back, trying to figure out how to contain that threat. You have the authorization for use of military force that Congress passed in 2001, specifically empowering the executive branch to fight that war. This is one of the ways that they're fighting it. If you have Al-Qaeda terrorists in Yemen or Mali or Pakistan, you know, plotting and planning against us, then they are enemy combatants, and we're trying to go after them. And frankly, whether it's drones or firing a bunch of cruise missiles or sending in the Marines, it's all part of the larger question of how we should prosecute this war. But it definitely could be more transparent. There's a ton of uneasiness in this country and amongst our allies about the way we've employed drones to basically do targeted killings of enemy combatants. And I think more transparency to explain that process and to offer the justification for it would help us in a variety of different ways.
You know, President Obama is criticized for being very much like the Bush administration on this. There have been issues raised by Republicans and Democrats on this. What would greater transparency look like in Congress and to the American people?
Well, I mean, it would explain the justification for the target list in a broader public way. I mean, why are, what are, what is the reason why an Anwar al-Awlaki or someone else is being targeted. As you know, some of this information was even withheld from the intelligence committees until a couple days ago, or I guess last week now. The administration reversed course and said they would provide that information. So it'd be providing a lot more information there. And I will say that in the last year in particular, the Obama administration has been much more public about their thinking on this. Mr. Brennan gave a very detailed speech on this 6 months ago, thereabouts, which laid out the thought process behind it. Attorney General Holder did the same thing. Jay Johnson, who's actually was the chief counsel for the Department of Defense, who's sort of tasked with the legal justification for all of these decisions, gave a speech on this as well. So they are greatly expanding their thinking and making it clearer to people, and I think that that does help. But then you've got the argument about, even if you understand the thinking, do you agree with it? Is this something we should be doing? And that would contribute to a larger debate, to be sure.
All right, Representative Smith, the president takes this out on the road now, and he's going to argue for it. Here's what Paul Ryan, the erstwhile Republican vice presidential candidate and still a colleague of yours in the House, had to say about that.
He seems to always stay in a campaign mode where he treats people of the other party as the enemy, not as partners. If he really wanted to get things done and govern, he would come here and work with us instead of campaigning all around the country.
That has been the meme today, that the Republicans are saying the president is just campaigning, and he didn't bring the Republicans in with his language. Does it make sense for him to be campaigning on this right now?
Well, he's not campaigning. He's making the case for his policies. And I think one of the things that you have to do is get broad public support for what you want to do. I mean, this Washington, D.C. is not where everything happens. I mean, it's kind of ironic that the Republicans would be making that argument. They're the ones who are always saying that Washington, D.C. is, not like the rest of the country. You've got to get out and, interact with the real people. And that's what the president's doing. He's making his case for his policies. And as far as aggressively, advocating for policies, I mean, the Republicans do the exact same thing. And the president's not going to, stop engaging with Congress. The problem right now is not a lack of engagement. The problem is a fundamental difference on the core policy issues and policy choices that we face. I think it's insane to insist on balancing the budget and not raising any taxes. I mean, that would require somewhere between a 30 and a 50% cut in Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, in everything. Those are the policies that the Republicans continue to insist on. And I'm sorry, there's nothing political or campaign-oriented about saying that's wrong. That's a bad policy for this country, and we need to make sure that it doesn't happen. And that's part of the public policy process.
All right, sir. I appreciate you taking the time. And if you run into Jamie Herrera Butler or Kathy McMorris Rogers or
I'll
Doc Hastings,
nice about you.
Tell them that we want them on our air and that our listeners want to hear from them.
Yeah, I will absolutely do that.
Thank you, sir. I look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you.
Bye. Representative Adam Smith, he is a representative from the 9th Congressional District in Washington State. More about what the president had to say about higher education, that's coming up.
KUOW News and Information, it's 9:22.
Support for KUOW comes from University of Washington School of Nursing, currently recruiting women between ages 18 and 45 with a medical diagnosis of IBS to participate in a study about IBS. More information and qualifying criteria online at uwibs.org.
47 degrees and overcast in Seattle's University District this morning. Our forecast is calling for cloudy skies with a chance of rain today, a high of about 50. Cloudy tonight, some rain's possible. We'll have a low around 46. And tomorrow there's rain likely in the morning, cloudy with a little chance of some rain during the afternoon tomorrow. We'll see a high of about 48 degrees.
Support for KUOW comes from UW Department of Genome Sciences, presenting a public lecture on primate genomics. Wednesday, February 20th, 7 p.m. Kane Hall 120, UW Seattle campus. Details at gs.washington.edu.
I'm Rob Wood. You can hear more on President Obama's State of the Union speech with Warren Olney on To the Point later this morning at 11 o'clock on KUOW.
Now we're going to take a look at higher education, whether we can still afford higher education. And the president nicely teed us up for that conversation. William Zumeda, Bill, is a professor of public affairs at the Evans School of Public Affairs at the University of Washington. He's been thinking about the costs of higher ed and how we pay for it and what it means. He joins us to talk about that. It's good to meet you and good to talk to you.
Glad to be here, Steve.
I appreciate that you came in. You wrote this article about, can we still afford higher education? It appeared in a few different places. Got curious about it. But as we said, the president was nice enough to tee us up talking about higher ed and talking about how we're going to pay for higher ed. And he made that, he made this argument about high schools, which I want to get to in a minute with you. But he made the argument about how in Germany, students graduate their last 2 years. They basically come away from a four-year school with an associate's degree, an equivalent of an associate's degree in the U.S. And then he went on to talk about the value of higher education or what it meant, but also the costs of higher education. And he said colleges have to play a part in that. And I wanted to play that part for you. Here's what he had to say.
Now, even with better high schools, most young people will need some higher education. It's a simple fact. The more education you've got, the more likely you are to have a good job and work your way into the middle class. But today, skyrocketing costs price too many young people out of a higher education or saddle them with unsustainable debt. Through tax credits, grants, and better loans, we've made college more affordable for millions of students and families over the last few years. But taxpayers can't keep on subsidizing higher and higher and higher costs for higher education. Colleges must do their part to keep costs down, and it's our job to make sure that they do. So tonight, I ask Congress to change the Higher Education Act so that affordability and value are included in determining which colleges receive certain types of federal aid. And tomorrow, my administration will release a new college scorecard that parents and students can use to compare schools based on a simple criteria: where you can get the most bang for your educational buck.
So there he was, sort of taking up exactly sort of the issues you wrote about, William Zumeda, in your article. How do we pay for college education and what's its value? So give me your reaction. Just first of all, I'm going to work backwards. This idea of a scorecard, how is it a good idea and how would it help me and my children understand what's valuable in college?
Well, college, we know that all the evidence is that college is exceedingly valuable for people. It's also good for the country generally. There are many benefits for having somebody educated that go beyond the dollars, extra money that individual will make, not only the extra taxes that he or she will pay, but many benefits for in terms of child raising, in terms of health, in terms of reduced dependency, and so on. So in general, higher education is a good thing. There's a lot of variation across different majors, different where you go to school, different levels of degrees, and it's the more information people have about what the implications are of their choices on those matters, the better. And costs are part of that. Actually, prices. Let's use the word prices to talk about what somebody pays for higher education. Costs being the resources that are actually used from wherever they come to produce the higher education. So there's a difference between cost and price. So it's a good thing. One of the things that makes markets efficient is that people have information about the value of the services they buy and about the price. And prices have not been that transparent, frankly.
You asked this question about in your article. You asked the question about, can we afford higher education? You were asking a rhetorical question, or is it something that you're actually wondering in your position? Can we afford it?
Well, we need to afford it. It's as the president talked about early childhood education. He talked about infrastructure. Those are investments that we need to make. They'll pay off in the long run. So, can we afford it? you have to think realistically about ramping up and about the condition of the economy and states and federal government's fiscal position and so on. So you don't necessarily make huge investments up front right now, but you phase in and you do what you can to move forward. And also there are as he says, places where things can be done more efficiently.
Well, you know, well, let me take the broader view, and let's start with that idea of pre-K. You know, the president talks about somehow encouraging states to advance their pre-K education. We don't have full-time kindergarten in the state funded. We do have early childhood learning center that the governor launched, Governor Gregoire. If you were looking from high on and wanted to put money somewhere, doesn't it make more sense to put money, the limited money we have, into pre-K and getting people ready rather than helping people who may not be ready to pay for college?
Well, we need...
We need both, but...
Yeah, we need to take care of all of our citizens. So you can't ignore the folks who are out there needing an education now and not allowing them to be successful in the workplace and in their lives and so on. So we do need to do we still need to do things at the post-secondary level. But early childhood education, I'm no expert on this, but it does have all the evidence is that it has a very high payoff if it's done at high quality.
Right. Well, would you say that same true for higher ed? The payoff is in terms of quality, or is it just the experience? Is there enough experience that makes it have some value?
Well, the higher quality has more value, let's put it that way. And there's certainly a minimum level of quality below which the higher education doesn't have much value in the labor market. So we're beginning to do they're beginning to come out analyses that allow us to figure out how much you need to make a difference. So there's a great piece of work that came out of the community college system in this state a few years ago now, called the tipping point research, which shows that where somebody's earnings really take off is after getting about a year's worth of higher education and a certificate that has meaning in the labor market. Then you begin to see the curve bend upward in terms of their earnings.
Well, which raises a question for me again about what the president was saying and where he pointed to what was happening in Europe, where we put a little more pressure on young people. I don't know if pressure is the word, but we ramp up the education expectations so that the last 2 years of high school, people are focused on where they might go in the short term. And that's basically what they're doing. Maybe somebody could go into an apprenticeship program in a union. They could turn to some kind of job, or they go to higher ed. It's a little more restricted, I understand, in Europe than here. Should higher education institutions, should the institution as a whole be working to that integrated moment there in those last 2 years, 16 to 18, before they get those students? And maybe that means not having them come to their institution.
If I'm understanding...
Oh, was it too obscure? Did I go too long? I wandered? All right. Should colleges say, 16 and 18-year-olds, we're going to help you with whatever you need in high school, not necessarily come to our schools?
We're going to help you in high school. Well, I'm sure exactly what you mean there, but there are things like this that are going on, and the state's one of the leaders.
Well, the president talked about it.
Yeah, so look at the Running Start program in the state. Now, a number of states have programs like that. Running Start is a program whereby the student in high school, typically juniors and seniors, can go to a college, often a community college because that's the nearest one, but some of the four-year institutions are involved too. And the student can take courses at the college without paying. The money goes with the student, and that program just continues to grow every year since 1990, and it's a leader in the country in this. So students, my own son had a year's worth of college credit when he got to graduated from high school. And so most of the courses are dual credit. You get both high school and college credit if you take chemistry.
But we don't have that for everybody in part because we have this sort of bifurcated system, and higher ed says, come to our school, you'll learn this. High schools say, well, you're going to learn up to here. Community colleges fill a gap, but not the gap. We seem to have very siloed education systems, and those continue. So when we argue more money for higher ed, make it more efficient, we're still arguing from a position of silos. And I was wondering, how do we need to break down those silos, and how do we do it?
It's very hard to break them down, but some steps are being taken along that line. I'm actually teaching a course about this right now. This is sometimes called K-16 policy or even P-20 policy, preschool to graduate school. So the idea of tightening up the seams in the system so that just, as you say, if there's sort of wasted time in the senior year of high school, that could be more effectively spent preparing the student for college or if he's not prepared already, or actually beginning college. So some of the states have done things like making sure that the state testing that's done in 10th or 11th grade has questions on it that allow them to tell whether the student is college ready. California piloted this with the California State University system. And so the student learns and the school learns and the student's parents learn in 10th or 11th grade what the student still needs to do to be ready for college. We have way too many students who graduate from high school who are not ready for college. They can't pass the placement test. They end up in remediation, and they never complete many times.
William Zemeta is a professor of public affairs at the Evans School of Public Affairs. He studies costs and benefits of education among his issues. So in the article you wrote, Can We Afford College? A central point here is that not everyone needs a four-year baccalaureate degree. And you say innovation in post-secondary education and training is desirable. And I'll get to what your caveat was. But is the innovation, what does that innovation look like in your mind in years ahead? You touched on some of the programs we have right now. What's the next step or the next steps? Do we break down classrooms more? Or do we stop funding institutions as much as some kind of outcomes? What's your biggest picture?
Well, I think we've seen a big shift in the last 10 or 15 years. One that I might not have predicted 20 or 25 years ago. A big shift from talking about teaching to talking about learning. So I think that's really important culture change. So that and you hear it in among faculty and so on too, and certainly from administrators, and I think it's permeated the institutions that I know about, that we're now paying attention to what matters for student learning, and really trying to figure out how to get students focused and through their programs. So so that's a kind of an innovation, and that may involve. That may involve increased use of technology, hybrid courses where the latest technology is used in a way that reduces the number of trips that the student has to make to campus. We know that there's also beginning to be we're well along on entirely online programs, courses and degree programs. So those are some of the important innovations that are coming along. But the focus always has to be on the student learning. The online may cost less in some ways. You don't have the buildings and so on. But you have to make sure that the students are actually getting something of value and are completing the programs and so on.
So the article that prompted this, Can We Still Afford Higher Education, Professor Zemeta, you wrote that in your caveats that innovation is desirable, but it implies the government must be more vigilant in monitoring results and protecting consumers. When the president talked about that in part, that's why he was talking about a report card for right. For colleges. What did you have in mind? What were you thinking?
Well, I think that on the whole, that learning more about the outcomes of college and being able to convey that information in an objective, credible way to people who are making decisions about where to go and what to major in and so on. Those are all good things.
We have private companies doing that now, right? I mean, I can buy different books about which is the best college for various
right.
aspects.
Right. But those have
inherent biases.
Yeah. And the sort of marketing efforts that are made around them can be over the top. You don't have comparability necessarily. So efforts to do this, but it is a market after all. So we're going to have institutions making their case. We're going to have private companies doing this. Having a government effort at this is not necessarily a bad thing, as long as but there has to be a lot of negotiation about it. What exactly goes into it? What kind of data is reported? And and how it's audited and those kinds of things. But information helps people make better decisions.
When you look at this issue of how do we afford higher education, you have to look at it in terms of what's happened in this state, for example, and the cuts from public subsidies to helping pay the cost of college for individual students. Private colleges are involved in this mix as well. How do you see public education, in particular, getting the dollars to educate students in the future, given the restrictions?
It's a tough question. It really is. We almost certainly need more revenue to be able to do to educate the number of people that we really need to educate. We export students. We have relatively low rates of completion of attainment of degrees. Although our institutions are pretty efficient in getting their students through, the ones who get to the institution get through at a high rate. we just don't have enough spaces, basically.
Slots.
Exactly. So there are some things that can be done to improve the throughput or the efficiency, like we were talking about before, the running start idea, the idea of continuing to work on improving transfer rates from community colleges. We have to 4-year institutions. We have a large 4-year a large community college system. So many of our students need to transfer if they're going to go on to a baccalaureate degree. But everybody doesn't need a baccalaureate degree. So the community colleges produce lots of certificates and associate's degrees and so on. And as I said, they've done research that shows that these certificates of 1 year or longer that represent that have labor market value represent a big bang for the buck for people. So they're trying to organize themselves to put their resources into things that pay off. And that's a good thing. So efficiency is the kind of thing you were talking about before, breaking down silos, making our system better connected. In the long run, those things will pay off.
You see that happening?
Oh, yeah, I do.
You talked about these efforts, bring students through community colleges, work down. But we still end up with these pockets of money that people fight over, right? K-12 fights over it, higher ed. They try to come together, but it's... Right. In the end, they're fighting over limited resources.
That's pretty tough. That's right. That's pretty tough. I mean, creative efforts could reward the systems for working together in certain ways, so that you get paid. You get paid for your if you're a K-12, a secondary school district, you get paid when. You don't get paid all your money until the student successfully matriculates and makes progress in the local community college or in a 4-year institution. The community college doesn't get its full payoff until the student is successful at transferring and graduating from a 4-year institution. So that so both sides of the partnership have an incentive, financial incentive, to work together.
I guess in a sense that's what the president was talking about when he compared his proposals to the Race to the Top proposals that work with the states to add incentives to some sort of success. You think there's support for that in the higher ed community overall?
Yeah, I think there will be. I mean, there'll be grumbling and resistance to change, of course, but if that's the way new money is available, then you're going to have to do it.
All right, sir. I appreciate you taking the time to talk about your article.
Okay. My pleasure, Steve.
William Zemeta is professor of public affairs at the Evans School of Public Affairs at the University of Washington. We have a link to Can We Afford Higher Ed? It's at our website, kuow.org.
KUOW News and Information. It's 9:43.
Support for KUOW comes from Bedrooms and More, family owned in Wallingford on Northeast 45th Street for over 30 years, a local resource for natural and organic mattresses with an extensive selection of natural bedding, pillows, and toppers. Online at bedroomsandmore.com.
47 degrees and overcast in Seattle's University District this morning. The forecast today, cloudy skies, a chance of rain later on. We'll have a high today of about 50 degrees. Cloudy with rain possible tonight. Expect a low around 46. And tomorrow there's rain likely in the morning. Cloudy skies, a chance of rain in the afternoon tomorrow. Expect a high of 48 degrees.
Dwight Yoakam, the coolest superstar in country music. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Well, I'm a honky-tonk man. Ain't a crazy
style. That's Sunday night at 7 o'clock here on KUOW.
Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Symphony, presenting violinist Itzhak Perlman in a single-night recital on February 19th at Benaroya Hall. Ticket information online at seattlesymphony.org.
President Obama says he'll bring half of U.S. combat troops home within 1 year. What's it like coming home from war? What was it like for you? If you have a story to share, please call our listener feedback line. That number is 206-221-3663, 206-221-3663. Your stories of coming home from war is the conversation with Ross Reynolds tomorrow at 1220 here on KUOW. I'm Rob Wood. One of the voting struggles in the United States has to do more with waiting than anything else. Find out what's being done to fix those long lines at the polls on The Takeaway this afternoon in the 1 o'clock hour here on KUOW.
Now let's look again at what the president had to say and some of the policies that he was talking about in his State of the Union. He called on Congress to make big reforms, not let the sequester occur. This self-inflicted threat by Congress to apply across-the-board cuts to the federal budget, supposed to force an all-encompassing budget negotiation. There are critics of Congress who think the cuts mandated by the sequester will be the only way to bring out needed Defense Department cuts. Here's what the president said, describing what the impact of the March 1st automatic spending cuts would have on the nation.
These sudden, harsh, arbitrary cuts would jeopardize our military readiness. They devastate priorities like education and energy and medical research. They would certainly slow our recovery and cost us hundreds of thousands of jobs.
William Harting is director of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy. William Harting, thanks for talking to us again.
Yes, thanks for having me.
What do you think the sequester would mean for the economy?
Well, I think it's certainly not an ideal thing to do. The economy's fragile. We've got a lot of vulnerability. But looking at the Pentagon part of it, certainly the kind of cuts called for under sequester are less than what we've seen in other build downs after Vietnam, after the Cold War. And we're winding out of Afghanistan. We're out of Iraq. We don't really have a Soviet Union or some big superpower adversary that requires the kind of spending that we're doing now. So, I think from a strategic point of view, cutting the Pentagon makes sense. And in terms of the economy, it's a much smaller piece nationally than the industry would have us believe. Obviously, some places like Seattle have a bigger investment because of companies like Boeing. But even them, they have a lot of contracts in the pipeline that'll keep them going past this March 1st deadline.
One place you wrote on the Hill's congressional blog, Congress blog, you wrote, here's the crucial point. The Pentagon can absorb an 8% reduction to a $500 billion-plus budget of the level called for by sequester while maintaining a strong defense, given smart management. Given smart management, isn't the critique that people who oppose the sequester have but still might support cuts to defense, like Adam Smith was talking about, our representative earlier in the hour, is that this is a meat cleaver, they can't move the money around efficiently, and programs that shouldn't be cut will be cut if the sequester goes through?
That's an issue. I mean, I think ideally you would have a similar level of cuts, but the Pentagon could have some flexibility to cut what doesn't work, to fund what does work. And colleagues of mine have made proposals about how you could get to the same level of cuts, $500 billion over 10 years, more gradually. So instead of taking most of the cuts up front, you phase them in over a couple of years. So that certainly would be a better way to manage it. But if it comes down to it and we do hit the sequester, I think the Pentagon has enough money and has enough wasteful programs that they could deal with it. You know, it wouldn't be the kind of disaster that we're hearing it would be from the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and less so from the president. You know, he hasn't really cranked up his rhetoric you know, quite to the same degree that some of the people who work in his administration have about the Pentagon part of it.
You know, an 8% reduction in the Defense Department budget, in terms of percentage, you mentioned it's less, but in terms of percentage, what kind of cuts are we talking about to our spending compared to the past and also compared to other nations?
Well, we spend more than the next 14 largest countries combined, and about 4 to 6 times what China spends, which is often viewed as sort of the adversary of the future. So if we cut by 8%, those margins are not going to change dramatically. Another way of looking at it is if the sequester hits, we'd be spending about what we spent in 2007, which at that point was one of the highest levels since World War II. Spending went up until about 2010, and now it's leveled off and come down ever so slightly. So we're spending far more than we spent during the Cold War in a very different environment where a lot of the things we're spending on, like large numbers of boots on the ground, are not likely to be come into play once we get out of Afghanistan. So, you know, I think it's, and compared to past buildups, it's, you know, probably 10 to 15% phased in over 10 years is not anywhere near, and it's probably, you know, about half what we did at the end of the Cold War. So it's the kind of thing that's been done before. We've handled it economically. The Pentagon's dealt with it. But obviously the contractors in the Pentagon would prefer to have more money, and they're not going to just say, you know, please take my contracts. They're going to put up a fight. So,
how is the other problem that people argue in terms of sequester? And again, we're focusing on the Defense Department here. We could go to other parts of the budget, which are also hit. But in the Defense Department budget, that it happens too fast. It's a too fast a dislocation. How quickly did other cuts? How quickly were other cuts implemented in the past on the Defense Department?
Well, at the end of the Cold War, over just a couple years' time, procurement was cut by 25%, weapons procurement. About 700,000 people were let go from the armed forces. So far more than anything we're looking at now. So some of the ways of getting at this, you know, getting this done, talk about maybe a few 100,000 troops being phased out over a couple of years, bringing us back to where we were before the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So it's milder, even in terms of the short-term effects. And if you look over the 10-year period, it's significantly, you know, less steep than what we've seen in other build-downs.
Well, then take me, as much as you can, take me behind the reasons for the concern over the sequester. The idea that it was put there because this would force Republicans to come to the table, and the other parts of the sequester cuts in the discretionary spending would force Democrats to the table. So why are we hearing, for example, from people like Rand Paul, who is saying, look, let's go for the sequester because we'll get the cuts we need to the federal government, sort of akin to what you're saying about let's go for the sequester because we'll get the cuts we need in the Defense Department. What's happening here?
Well, it is a strange bedfellows kind of situation. And I, as I mentioned in my article, I would much prefer them to come up with a balanced package, not have to go through sequester. But if it does occur, I feel that the Pentagon can handle it. And I think part of what's brought us to this point is that shift in the Republican Party, where you've got people like Rand Paul and others who are saying, if this is the only way we're going to get spending cuts, I'll accept cuts to the Pentagon. It may not be their first choice, but they think that the normal process is just going to keep kicking the can down the road. So it's a different situation. You've got people like Buck McKeon, head of the House Armed Services Committee, screaming from the rooftops, we can't cut a penny from the Pentagon. But then you've got people like Representative Mick Mulvaney, a Tea Party from South Carolina, saying, well, of course we can. The Pentagon's got to be on the table. If this is the only way to get reductions in spending, let's jump off the so-called cliff. So it's, you know, some of the action or the gridlock is as much on the Republican side as it is between Republicans and Democrats.
When you look at the larger question, if we jumped off the cliff and some of those other programs that were impacted, NIH, CDC, transportation policies, can they absorb the cuts?
I think it would be a lot harder in those areas because they don't have the cushion of money sitting there like the Pentagon contractors have. They haven't had their budgets doubled in the last 10 years. We're in a vulnerable position. The economy still hasn't really recovered, so a lot of these programs needs are higher than they used to be. So I was mostly looking at the levels, that the Pentagon could absorb those levels. I would very much like to see a solution to this that doesn't involve all these domestic programs getting hit. They would give the Pentagon more flexibility in how they impose cuts, not necessarily give them more money, but, you know, a little more flexibility of how to reduce their spending. So, you know, we're in the midst of we're not being given very great choices here. But on the Pentagon side, I do think even if the worst came to be, they could adjust without hurting our defense, and we could at least minimize some of the economic impacts. But, you know, push comes to shove, I would say let's have a deal that deals with revenues, that deals with reducing the Pentagon, that takes sort of a compassionate view of what we can do to save on the domestic side without depriving people of services that they need.
Well, William Hartung, push coming to shove, what would a Defense Department budget look like, do you think, if they do come to a deal? From what you've looked at, how much would be cut from defense?
Well, I would think the Pentagon will get more under a deal than they would get under sequester. So I think in the short term, maybe $200 to $300 billion cuts over 10 years instead of $500 billion. But I think, you know, the thing about this crisis is it's not the end of the story. Whatever they decide on March 1st, they could change on March 15th, or they could change in the following fiscal year. Or so it's just, I think it's going to be an ongoing battle over how to strike a balance between Pentagon and domestic spending, what kind of revenues we're going to raise. And so this is kind of a, you know, one of those crucial turning points, but it's not going to be the end of the story. So a lot of the arguments being made now about not letting the Pentagon, you know, subject to sequester are the same arguments that are going to be made during a budget deal, during next year's budget negotiations. And that's why I think it's important to understand that they can certainly absorb those levels of cuts that sequester calls for, even if it's done in a different fashion.
They could, the sequester could occur, and they could come back 5 days later and say, we're giving you X flexibility to move money around?
Yes, they certainly could do that. Or they could decide a month or two from now, oh, you know, here's a deal we can live with. And then the sequester would only be relevant for a few months. There's really no, I wouldn't put any bets on what they can get done in Washington these days, but I don't think March 1st is going to be the end of the story.
If you don't buy this magazine, we'll shoot this dog. A self-inflicted threat, and it's some people are thinking they're going to execute it just to see what happens.
Well, it's not pretty, that's for sure.
William Hartung, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
William Hartung is author of Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. He is also co-editor with Miriam Pemberton of Lessons from Iraq, Avoiding the Next War. His previous books have included And Weapons for All, which is a critique of U.S. arms sales policies. He's been working on these issues for a long time. He is the director of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy.
And now, the sound of the day.
That's the sound of the relatively new fence along the Aurora Avenue Bridge rattling in the wind. Weekday listener Paul noticed the sound and recorded it as he was walking along that very busy thoroughfare. A lot of history, a lot of emotion to that walk, too. So what interesting sounds are you hearing as you travel around your city, your suburb, your field, your farm, your boat? Record 30 seconds of it. We want to hear the sound of your day and tell us the story behind it. Put sound of the day in the subject line. Email it to weekday@kuow.org. Look forward to hearing your sounds. By the way, we post extra sounds, extra bits of stories, extra information on our Facebook page, Weekday on KUOW. You can find that and like us, and you'll get notified when we have some extras and also some questions that we're asking. For example, we're asking you who played the best president in the films, in movies, or on television. So if you have an opinion on who is the best celluloid or video president, share it with us. We're going to talk about that with Robert Horton in just a little bit. You can also follow us on Twitter. You can also go to our KUOW.org page, see what's happening there as well. Stay with us. We're going to review the news of the week from Canada. We're going to talk about presidential performances. We're going to take a look at the economy and talk again with Michael Parks about what he heard in the president's speech that might give him hope or pause as the president tries to make some changes to employment practices in this country. That's all coming up on Weekday, KUOW, Seattle.
More of Weekday right after we check the headlines. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. Online at KUOW.org.
Support for KUOW comes from City People's Gardens Design and Landscape, offering full garden design, installation, and maintenance services.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.